Welcome to The Running Public with Bracken Crocker and Kirk DeWint.
Whether you are a brand new runner or you already have a great mustache,
we're here to help you increase your running knowledge and present it at a practical level. This is The Running Public. When you're ready to take your training or racing to the next level, go to therunningpublic.com. We have both monthly subscription training plans, $19.99 a month, and Bracken and I both offer one-on-one customized coaching. Again, go to therunningpublic.com and check out our offerings.
I'm sitting in my car.
Outside of what?
Outside of my high school that I teach at.
Is this your prep?
Yes, this is my planning period.
Wow. And we get you during your prep time. Preps are sacred for teachers, Kirk.
I'm so sorry and thank you. You don't know that yet, actually. You don't know if we're worth it yet, Maura.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So how long do you have? Because I know you're probably working with a somewhat of a window.
I'm actually, this is the last period of the day and it's a 90-minute period, so we're good.
Look at that. How did you manage to get the final block off?
I don't know. I got really lucky. Just the luck of the draw.
Is it, I just did some creeping on your socials. Dayton? Are you in Dayton?
Yeah, Dayton, Ohio.
The big city. Bracken has no idea how we got here, so I feel like we should tell Bracken and our listeners how this conversation became. And I actually don't know how people involved here, but you just ran Boston. How far off of Boston are you? Like 4 days?
Yeah. So it was Monday. So yeah, 4 days.
4 days. So Bracken, you don't know this, but I coach Maura's friend, Kira. And was it last week or 2 weeks ago, Kira started back up with me. She had taken a break with some life transition stuff. And she said, hey, just so you know, the first week back together, I may go a little rogue on you. And I was like, why? And she said, well, my fast friends are in town and they don't know how to run slow. Come to find out, one of those fast friends that made Kira deviate from her first week back together is you, Maura. So you have some explaining to do.
I'm so sorry. I'm a bad influence.
I believe the term one-stepper was used, and I don't know if it was in regards to you or somebody else in the training group. Who's the one-stepper?
It could have been either of us, but my gut wants to say that was not me, that was Lizzie, my sister-in-law.
So Bracken, that's how this conversation came to be. And then after you ran Boston, the 10th American female, is that correct? Finisher at Boston?
Yeah.
Awesome. Kira texted me immediately. It was like, I told you my friends were fast. Look what my friend Maura did. And then here we are today. So that's how this came to be. Can you make sense of that?
Yes, I can.
So we don't know each other yet, but prior to going all in on this running, coaching, podcasting thing, I was a high school teacher and I tried doing the teaching and pursuing running route. And it was great, but I know the feeling of coming home after a race. Did you have an entire school invested in you? Did you get a hero's welcome when you came back or did you fly under the radar?
I did. No, I definitely got a hero's welcome. Actually, there was a pep rally the day of Boston. It had nothing to do with Boston, but we had already planned a pep rally. And at the end of the pep rally, one of my teacher friends got the entire student body to congratulate me on camera, and they made a video of it. So, and then when I came back to school, I had my department had decorated my door, and they'd gotten me donuts. So yeah, definitely didn't fly under the radar.
That's always cool, though, having that school and community tied into that.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a great.
What do you teach?
Chemistry.
Chemistry. Very nice.
So she's smarter than we are.
I don't know about that.
So tell us, we do these podcasts many ways, right? We just kind of roll into conversation. Sometimes we have structure. Sometimes we don't. But we don't often talk to a guest that we don't know like anything about. And other than Instagram stalking you, which I gathered you were a teacher, you have 3 kids, you're married, you work full time,
yep.
And you happen to be sort of fast and doing it all. Correct. What am I missing?
Your Instagram stalking. Your Instagram stalking just has it all. I guess the only other thing is I'm also in a band with my husband and my brother-in-law. So,
what kind of band are we talking?
It is a bluegrass band.
Good for you. What do you play?
I play the Bodhran, which is an Irish drum. So it's the one that you hold it up here and then you play it with a stick like this.
Who's on vocals? Or me. All three? You?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we share a lot of vocals, but I'm the main vocalist.
Well, this is something I'm going to have to hear. Not I'm not asking you for it right now per se, but like after this.
Wait, I have my drum right back here.
How convenient. Is there any chance it's in your trunk?
It is no? It actually is at home, but I had it yesterday. But
well, Kirk's in Minnesota. I'm in Milwaukee. So it's nice to hear an accent or lack of accent. It's nice to hear someone talking in a pure, preordained way.
The pure way, yes.
Yes.
We don't have an accent.
Nope.
I'm not hearing anything. All right. So let's get to know you a bit first, because there's a lot to dive into, actually, with you just on paper, being like, okay, I have to imagine looking around at Boston this weekend, if you comb through the results of any of the women that finished somewhere around you or in front of you, their resume isn't going to look quite the same as yours. Probably how they spend their day isn't going to look quite the same as yours. How they manage their time isn't going to resemble yours. Their vocal prowess probably isn't going to resemble yours. All sorts of things. The ability to do math. But I think to start with, we should probably get to know like where you came from, who you are, your background a bit, because I don't know it. I gathered you ran collegiately, but I think we should even go before then. So like, just tell us who you are to start, and then we'll start getting into the weeds soon. But I think it'd be good to get to know you off the bat. So who are you? Where are you from?
Okay. So I'm originally from Akron, Ohio, home of LeBron James. And I actually went to his rival Catholic high school. So we never overlapped. He graduated a year before I was a freshman in high school, but I went to Archbishop Hoban High School. And the only other like big famous person from Archbishop Hoban is the meme Bad Luck Brian, like the one with the redheaded kid in the vest going that meme. Mm-hmm. He was a year younger than me. He graduated from Hoban.
Can I interrupt you quickly?
Yes.
How old are you?
I'm 35.
Okay. I had a teammate from Akron. Do you know Varel Taylor?
No, the name does not sound familiar.
Never mind then. Carry on.
Okay. But I'm the oldest of seven kids. And my dad was a track coach, and I did a lot of other sports in grade school, and I wasn't good at any of them. Because I have no hand-eye coordination, a lot of spirit, a lot of drive, but no talent. And so when I got to high school, I actually went out for the play to see if that was where my talents, if that's where my people were. And I got cut, and I was really upset. And so my dad was like, "Oh, you've always been, you know, pretty good at running around."
Why theater is a cut sport.
I guess.
Wow.
Wasn't good enough. They were not impressed with my monologue from Steel Magnolias.
Can't you just like play a tree or something in theater? Like, okay, you got downgraded to being a mailbox. And you're like, I'll be the mailbox.
They saw what I was working with. They saw what I was working with, and they were like, "We're all set, actually."
That's a bold. We are good. It's a power move to go Steel Magnolia monologue, though.
I don't know any other way to be. But my dad suggested that I go out for the cross country team because famously they do not cut. So I went out for the cross country team and very quickly found out that this was something I was good at. And, I made it to state, my freshman year, and that kind of just finding out that was something that it's a place where I could shine, kind of dictated the rest of my high school career. I did track as well. Had a lot of success in high school in track and cross country.
Can I stop you real quick?
Sure.
Well, obviously it's not like, it's probably one of those things where for me, it was very similar. when I switched from soccer to cross country, I won my first meet and I was like, I'm a man all of a sudden. And then I was like recognized as, I was instantly like the runner guy, right? Like I went from, I was a pretty good athlete around, luckily, but when I found running, it was like I was the runner, right? And then it just made sense to me. But there was glimmers of it. Like I could outrun my soccer team. At gym class, they forced you to do the mile and I would kick everyone's butt, right? And so I kind of knew. Did you kind of know, or were you like real surprised? Come on now.
I kind of knew, but I was also, I was homeschooled from, second through seventh grade. And so, I didn't have as many opportunities to kind of discover that. I would go running with my dad. And he would always say like, oh my gosh, you're so much faster than me. But I always kind of thought that he was like, just hyping me up because he was my dad. But I didn't really get a chance to like compete against other people running until I was always very competitive, but, didn't actually get a chance to compete against people until high school.
Okay. And were you actually that bad at everything else? Like, I think like in hindsight, we like to be like, oh, I sucked at everything else. And then like, were you literally like defeat after defeat after defeat? Like, I'm no good. I'm no good. I'm no good. And then that rhetoric changed, or are you embellishing?
Yes. I'm not embellishing. And to this day, I am very, very bad at just about every other sport. No hand-eye coordination. I'm not embellishing. It's just, I'm a one-trick pony.
That's why they gave you the stick to beat on a drum with in the band versus like a string instrument or something.
Honestly, I'm joking.
The only reason I learned
how to play the drum is because you're not far off, because in bluegrass, nobody is just a vocalist. Like everybody plays something in a bluegrass band, and it was either learn the drum or I was going to play like the triangle or something like that. Like you're not far off.
Okay. All right. I'm done picking on you. I didn't mean to interrupt. If Bracken wants to jump in with something, please. Otherwise you can continue.
How big was your high school?
About 800 students.
Okay.
So
big enough that you got to compete against enough talent around you. Did you believe from the start, like, this is going to be what I do? Or was it just cool to have success at something?
No, it was absolutely just like cool to have success. It was cool to be known for something, like known for being good at something, to have success at something. It was where I made all of my friends. It was kind of how I made a name for myself around the high school. I didn't even know that running in college was a thing until I was
your dad a coach?
My junior year. And he was a high school coach, but like, it was just not something we ever really talked about. Again, also remember, I'm the oldest of seven kids. So college, this is my parents' first kind of go round with college as well. And, I wasn't really aware that running in college was a thing that people did until I started receiving some letters from colleges. And in my senior year, I went on a few official visits, and Dayton, the University of Dayton, was actually my first official visit that I went on. And I left there like, this is where I want to go. I want to go here. And my mom was like, well, we're going to visit a few other colleges. But I ended up committing to Dayton. And most of that was because I just fell in love with the team atmosphere. The girls treated each other like family, and they also, running was secondary to community. And for me, running has always been about community. It is how I found my community in high school. I chose a school, a college where running was second to the community of the team. And it is how I found my community post collegiately. Some other schools that I visited, you know, the girls were really competitive with each other, or they were very into like dieting and supplements and all of the stuff that I was not familiar with. And it didn't feel like home, and UD felt like home. And then the other thing that really drew me to UD was the coach at the time, Ann Alianak, is an amazing runner in her own right. She finished seventh at the Olympic trials in 2008. So she is an amazing runner, and I'd never had a female coach, and everything about the way she ran that program really drew me in as well.
It's interesting. We got to see the different sides of collegiate sports running, the D1 side, the D3 side. And then I watched my sister come through and compete at a mid-major. And by the time she was done, I was pretty convinced that mid-majors are the sweet spot of college athletics, where you get the support and a bit of the facility of a D1 program and a bit of the family and relaxation of D3 without it being like a total free-for-all or whatever. I fell in love kind of a bit with that mid-major experience.
Yeah, I think my experience at UD, with UD being D1, was not typical of a lot of D1 athletes. Mm-hmm. I think that sense of community and the focus of Anne on each of us as people first and athletes second, I think that is not typical. And just knowing other athletes, you know, that are still competing now, it seems like those that went through D1 programs seem a lot more jaded about their college experience, to the point where either it put them off running, or they had to find something else about running that they loved because it just hadn't come together for them in college. But that was not my experience. Anne kind of opened up the possibility to me that running post collegiately was a thing that people did as well. She was sponsored by Brooks and running at the professional level and also working and also became a mom. So
that's Bracken and I majorly ran D3, but we both spent stints D1. I finished my career D1. Bracken started his career D1 and then went D3.
I got hot and I faded.
yes. Well, and us D, so I'm 40, Bracken's 36, about to be 37, right, Bracken? We got our birthdays coming up.
That's right.
So Bracken and I have birthdays a few days apart. We always beg our listeners for reviews on our birthday. So listeners, beware. It's
not
coming
this year.
But
just shoes.
No. Oh, yeah. You want shoes. I want reviews and shoes. All right. Anyways, we kind of hang our hats. There's this side conversation saying, like, if you put like D3 All-Americans versus D1 All-Americans from our generation, I went to school 2001 to 2005, and you made them race each other today, D3 would win. Because the D3 athletes had a decent experience. They carried it further into life. They aren't jaded. Like you said, mm-hmm. I'm one of them. I'm still pushing hard at 40. Bracken's pushing hard at 36. And I think there's some truth to that. Like, is there any more? I guess you didn't go to one of the schools that became toxic or overwhelming or consumed with running. But do you have any other perspective on that? Like, do you know any other friends that went to a very intense, we'll call it, program and got spit out? Do you have any connections that way?
Yes. Do you want me to name names of colleges specifically or just keep it very vague?
Whatever you want. We have no allegiance here, but whatever. I don't care.
But vague is fine if you want to be vague.
Okay.
Yeah, vague is fine. Yeah.
So I have had friends and people that I knew as runners in high school that went on to majorly competitive D1 colleges and were told things like, you don't look like a runner, you need to lose weight. The focus on the running program was designed to just break runners, and it was just like the team was so massive that you just got better. The team was good by attrition. Like some people couldn't hack it and they fell off, and there were just a few people in that program that could handle the incredibly high mileage, the incredibly high intensity of the program, and they did well. And usually if the program was big enough, you had 7 to 10 runners that would just do phenomenally. And so they were these big powerhouse schools. But if you looked further down their ranks, there were people that had been incredibly successful as high school athletes who were not performing as well in this D1 program. They weren't even living up to their high school potential because they were just, they were kind of just not in a program that help them to succeed. It was a program that was just there for the program to succeed. And if that makes sense. I know a lot of
Think about
runners,
even like
female
like you think about some of the best in our sport now, like Parker Valby, who just is obviously, you know, you can't watch a big race without seeing her be light years out front. And it's like, if she went to one of those schools and didn't have a coach who listened, she'd be the one who you threw at the wall and broke and she wouldn't stick, right? Like, so you do lose a lot of talent. Luckily, she's not one of them. She runs 3 days a week. She's just the prime example of like, yeah, D3, it was like, okay, you're a freshman. Great. Go run 6 to 8 today while the seniors went out and did 12 to 14. It was like, let's procure you. We don't need to break you. Anyways, they end up broken is what you're getting at, huh?
Yes. And a lot of, especially, I'm so sorry.
That's all right. For especially female years, that was my audio. So I'm glad it's yours now.
Especially female athletes, but also male athletes. I know anecdotally of a lot of eating disorders that have developed in collegiate running programs. And that's not specifically a D1 issue, but, it certainly isn't helped when you're surrounded by the best of the best and you're trying to find any way to like squeeze out that last drop of potential. And a lot of times that, when you're trying to find a way to optimize, you tend to look at, well, what does my body look like? And maybe if I don't look like the top runner on the team, what can I do to make my body look more like hers or look more like his? And so I saw a lot of eating disorders develop and struggle. Even in a great program like I was in, I struggled with that a little bit as well in college.
Okay, so let's talk. I was just curious about your perspective there because obviously you have it. And we've had how many conversations, Bracken, with Division I athletes? The eating disorder thing comes up almost with every collegiate Division I high-end athlete in some, whether it's personal or it's their roommate or it's, you know. So we've definitely had those conversations. But I was just curious about the perspective there. What I also am curious about is, because we're going to end up talking times because we gotta. So let's talk about what you did high school and college, because it's going to give perspective on where you are today. So why don't you talk to us about how, what were the markers you were hitting, high school, college, whatever they are, just for perspective once we start jumping further down the line?
Sure. So in high school, my fastest 5K cross country was 1905. Never broke into the 18s in high school. And honestly, high school running was very different back in 2003 to 2007. 1905 at a D2 school, I finished fifth my freshman year, and I was seventh my senior year, and my times between those two were very similar. I think I was 1907 my freshman year and 1905 my senior year. So I didn't really see a lot of progress in my times in high school, but I was very consistent, like consistently in that low 19 range. And that was honestly the reason I stayed there for so long was that was enough to get me top five at most of the races I was doing. And that was good enough for me. I was in a program that was doing maybe 15 to 20 miles a week, very, very low mileage program. I was pretty far and away the best on the team. I was pretty close to being the best on the boys team as well. So there was just like, again, it was a way that I found my community, but I didn't have a smartwatch. Those weren't even really a thing. I didn't track my mileage. I had no idea what other high school runners were doing. I was just kind of very just out doing whatever my coach told me to do, like go run this race. Oh, okay. That sounds good. And then when I got to college, I went from this very small, low mileage program to a much higher mileage program. And I saw huge drops in time. Like I got in, I ran a 17:45, after like my fourth or fifth race, my freshman year. Oh. So I dropped like a minute and a half, and then I immediately got injured, because I was also, restricting my food, not eating enough. I was very worried about my body fat percentage, and I got a stress fracture. So I had like a month of amenorrhea where I didn't get my period, and then got a stress fracture, and I was out for the rest of my freshman cross country season. So, I learned my lesson early, and thankfully kind of had people around me that helped me realize what the issue was. And then, coming back from that into my sophomore, junior, and senior year, I think I got maybe into like the low 17s. I don't know exactly my PR in cross country because the courses were also varied. Low 17s, maybe in a 5K. And then in track, my best performance was probably the 3K, the indoor 3K. I ran a 929 or 928. And I got to actually race against Molly Huddle at Notre Dame's big indoor track meet. And my goal was just to not get lapped by her. Succeeded. It was a close thing, but I did not get lapped. And then on the track in college, outdoor at 1640s for my fastest 5K and high 34s. Or I'm sorry, low 34s for my fastest 10K. I don't, these are all so long ago. I don't remember the exact times, but that's the range.
That freshman year when you came in, what did your mileage bump from 15 to 20 up to what?
Probably 50 to 60.
Okay. And the calorie restriction along with a, you know, mileage and triplicate, was that something that started internally or was that modeled by teammates and upperclassmen, or were there comments from above? What kind of planted that seed?
So, honestly, it started, what I can pinpoint it to was it started in the weight room. Because before we would go for our weight training, like once every 2 or 3 weeks, we would get body fat percentage, like our body composition done with the little calipers. So, right. The weightlifting coach, would like, you know, pull up our shirts and grab pieces of skin and measure like the with the calipers. And then he put all of the metrics in and he'd tell us our body fat percentage. And I remember one time he compared my body fat percentage to another one of the freshmen and hers was lower than mine. And he said, "That's so interesting. Your times are faster than hers, but her body fat percentage is lower. I wonder what you could do if you got your body fat percentage a little lower, you know?" One of the phrase that I really remember standing out was, same engine, lighter car. And that I just kept kind of thinking that. And so, I wasn't in my mind. I wasn't my freshman year mind. I wasn't restricting. I was just making healthier choices. What those healthier choices looked like were absolutely not enough carbs, absolutely not enough fat, absolutely not enough protein.
That's such a great example that we can't think out loud with important topics around, especially young athletes, because there's no way of controlling the thing that sticks. I've talked about it on here a lot that my freshman year before my first indoor race, I had never run an indoor race and I had never been in a position to win a race. And my coach said, "Well, just don't take the lead until you know you can keep it." And I fought and struggled with front running then as a result my entire high school and college career. And it was an innocent thing. It was a good piece of advice for a freshman who's never run an indoor race, but it stuck. And to say, "Huh, I wonder how good you'd be if you had less body fat." That's just like it's almost a throwaway line that it's just devastating. So what was the purpose?
Yes.
What was the purpose of their test? Was this we are going to test your body fat so that we can track levels throughout the year and ensure that you don't swing too big one way or another? Or was this just like the weight room guy, like, "Hey, we're putting all our metrics down because that's what we do"?
It could have been either. My gut tells me that it was probably, you know, to get an idea of where your body fat and your weight is at top performing levels. Like, we have this idea of your racing weight. Like, what's your weight at your top performance? Like right when you peak, which, in my humble opinion, what I know now is complete BS, but at the time that was probably the thought behind it was, you know, let's see how performance stacks up to these metrics, because this is a metrics driven sport. And I mean, now people have so many more metrics to hyper focus on. I mean, it's almost worse now with smart watches giving you your number of calories burned and your heart rate. And none of those things are accurate, but we put so much stock in them. You can find out how well you sleep every night and your oxygen saturation. And again, how accurate are these? But we put so much stock in those numbers.
There is no quicker way to make someone feel not good about themselves than to pinch your waistline with the calipers. At my absolute skinniest, tiniest, emaciated I've ever been in my life was my freshman year of cross country in college. And we got pinched, and then they did the suspension test with some grad students who were doing some exercise phys project and just walked out of there like, man, I have so much extra back there. And, you know, already emaciated, already under fueling. And it just is a very demeaning test. And there's a place for body fat testing, but to just stand there and get pinched there, you can't help but feel fat in your own mind.
Yes. Yeah. I definitely was a new experience for me. That wasn't something that people were really doing in high school. But I just kind of thought like, oh, this is the big leagues. This is what we do. They need all this information. And that was probably where it started for me. Luckily, it also kind of ended there, because after I got injured, I had a conversation with my mom and with the doctor who diagnosed me with the stress fracture. And we kind of figured out like, I think I know where this came from. It wasn't just the mileage. So luckily I had a doctor who at the time was probably maybe even a little ahead of his time, asking questions about not just my dietary habits. Cause I think, you know, most doctors at the time would have just said, oh, you went from running 15 to 20 miles to running 50 to 60 miles, boom, stress fracture. That makes sense. But this doctor actually took some time to talk a little bit about my eating habits. And, that was during that conversation that I learned that the whole 2000 calories thing is complete. I don't know. I don't know how you guys feel about cursing on this show.
Really good.
Clean.
But we try. We try our best too. Although I'm not very good at not
Kurt
doing
loves
it. So.
But my mom listens. So those are your two parameters.
Okay. Got it. All right. I'll try to keep it in there. But I was trying to keep it to, you know, between 1700 and 2000 calories, which was nowhere near enough for the amount of running that I was doing. I was kind of lucky that I had a doctor that was willing to walk through that with me.
So then coming out of that, obviously, from what I'm gathering anyways, I'm sure it wasn't all just butterflies and rainbows, like reestablishing good habits again, but is that really how it went? Like you had a good talking to, you understood possibly, and you fixed it, right? You ate more and then what happened? I mean, is that how it went? And then if so, what happened next with your running?
So in my mind, looking back on it now, that's how it went. But in reality, it was probably more of like a roller coaster of struggling with comparing myself to other runners and then putting the blinders back on and fueling my body properly with what I needed. So in my mind, it was like, no, that fixed the problem. But reality is probably it was more of an up and down process. It's definitely something I've been trying to unlearn even now. And especially coming back after having kids, issues with not looking like other professional runners at the starting line, my race photos not looking like other professional women's race photos. That has been something that I've kind of had to go back and continue that education of, you know, what do fast bodies look like? What does appropriate fueling look like? So it's definitely been an ongoing process, but I did stop severely restricting after my freshman year.
You know what?
What I have found.
So I've struggled with injury for, years and years. I've had, I don't know, 9 stress fractures. College freshman year, bumped up mileage, lost 8 pounds, stress fracture, right? We have similar stories, and I wasn't restricting on purpose. I think I just didn't understand how much I needed to eat to maintain. And even through, you know, what is this, Bracken? I've been healthy for 4 years now almost, which for me is an eternity. And I think a lot of it has to do with two things. It has to do with my metabolism slightly slowing. So I think my underlying demand is just a little less. And I find the right amount of food is where I kind of feel like I overdid it a little bit, like at a meal a day or something, and always snacking. If I have to say I'm a little hungry, grab something right away. And I almost feel like the right sweet spot when you're training as much as we are is actually like a little bit like you feel a little like I feel a little weighed down often because I'm eating a little more than I probably need to in my mind. I'm just a little, but I'm maintaining weight. My workouts are going well. I've been healthy. And it's almost that feeling like, ugh, after like a big dinner when you're ravenous and you've had a big day, right? But almost that's the fueling it takes. Not the I still want and crave and need more after every meal to stay lean and mean. It's almost like, no, I'm satiated now. And I almost feel a little heavy afterwards because we need to overdo it in order to just simply maintain our output. And I found that balance these last handful of years. Like, I think I'm just eating more. Maybe my metabolism's a little slower, but like I kind of feel ick very often after like a day of eating or a dinner, but yet I'm not losing weight. So clearly I think I needed to swing on the other end. I know that it's subjective and it's different for everybody, but do you believe that's maybe what it takes to properly fuel is like overdoing it, even recognizing that I might be overdoing it a little bit? That's how I feel.
100%. I really couldn't agree more. The number of just again, very anecdotally, but the number of times that I've heard fellow runners say things like, I just don't understand why I'm still hungry. I ate so much. It's like what you are doing is not typical. It is not normal. Right. The amount of stress that you're putting on your body requires more food than maybe even your eyes understand, but your body knows how much you're supposed to eat. And if you keep eating until you are full and then an hour down the road, you're hungry again, you didn't eat enough, eat more. And I think it's kind of, overcoming that idea of, you know, there's so much bad information out there about poor eating habits, like don't eat after this time, you know, whatever that time is, because it changes. Like don't eat after 8 p.m. or limit your number of 12 p.m. or 11 a.m. You know, there's just so much information out there, and it's hard to know what is the quote unquote right way to eat. And my current philosophy is just my body knows what's best. If I'm hungry, I'm eating. If I'm thirsty, I'm drinking. Those who know me will know that I still don't drink enough water. I struggle with hydrating, but yeah, just trusting your body because it knows what it needs. And if there are days where I finish a really long run and for like the next 24 to 48 hours, I'm craving sugar, just like as much candy, cookies, like simple carbs as possible. And I just listen because that must be what my body needs. And I think that can be scary, especially for athletes that maybe have been brought up in a culture of restriction or brought up with these ideas of one running community about clean eating, which I think is just a really, really sneaky way of hiding an eating disorder is just hyper fixating on clean eating. I mean, there's a term for it now that didn't exist 20 years ago, orthorexia, which is shit. And I think that is what plagues a lot of elite, sub-elite, and even just regular runners.
Yeah, you hear all the time from athletes that, oh, I'm doing this training block and I'm always hungry and it's annoying. And we forget that it's like going on a road trip. You're used to filling your car up once a week, and suddenly it's annoying to pull over every 3 hours to fill up. But it doesn't mean that you're overfueling. Like your tank's getting low because you're driving faster and farther, and you have to stop and fill up. And we understand that on a road trip. I'm going to have to stop every 300 to 400 miles and just fill back up, and that's what we do. But suddenly when it's us doing the exact same thing, it's like, well, I already ate twice and it's only 4 p.m. No, you're on a road trip. You're on the highway. You just have to stop and fuel. There's no other way around it.
And we don't treat any other bodily function like that, right? Like you never hear people saying like, I really have to pee, but I just peed like 2 hours ago, so I probably shouldn't. Like it's a normal bodily function, and yet we treat it like something that needs to be hyper controlled.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Unless you're on a road trip. And then
it's annoying. You have hours.
Because we have places to be.
You talked about what does a body look like? What does fast look like? And it's interesting because Kirk and I are huge running nerds, and we watch everything there is to watch. And there has been a shift in what fast looks like in the past. Even just like, I feel like this Olympic cycle, it's really coming to light. But we were watching, for example, World Indoors, and Ellie Perrier St. Pierre is pulling away and just running this phenomenal race for a U.S. athlete. And my middle child looks at us and goes, Dad, look how strong that one is. And my wife and I just kind of look at each other like, yeah. And you didn't used to see speed look strong. It had to look tiny, and it had to look too small. It had to look unattainably small. And now we have this, and it's not even just the U.S. athletes anymore. You have this distant contingent around the world that strong looks fast now, even up at the marathon level. I forgot what we were watching recently, Kirk, but the marathon league group just had a bunch of muscular athletes running. People that, people who had given birth and people who had found the weight room, and it just didn't look like what speed used to look like. And that's kind of encouraging to me at this point. Uh-oh, we lost her?
I'm worried we lost her.
If you can hear us, you're frozen. It might not be a bad idea to exit the link and then come back in.
This happens once in a while. You know what happens is when you're on your phone and the phone gets really hot. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I am so sorry. That is my bad. My internet started cutting out, and so I decided to get a little closer to the building. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep, all good.
This is good. And we got birds in the background, which is very nice. Very nice.
Soothing.
Yeah.
Well, Bracken made just a really good point.
A little bit of what you were saying about...
What did you catch?
All you. Go for it.
I'm sorry. I think there's a bit of a
Can
lag.
You hear us?
Yes, now I can.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did
I
you
catch? I was just saying that my middle daughter or middle child was commenting because she's in soccer and wrestling, and she's grown up watching us run and everything, but she was excited by how strong some of the women looked at indoor worlds and then at U.S. Olympic trials where they were athletes running and moms running rather than just that unattainable, like classic East African look. And even many of the East Africans now look like they are training, not just existing as runners. And it might be the most positive body template we've seen for young runners growing up with since I've been aware of running.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I went to high school at the same time as Bridget Franick was in high school. She was a year older than me, but I remember being at state my junior year, her senior year, when she won the mile, the 2 mile, the 4x8, and the open 8. So she had 4 gold medals at state, and all people could talk about was, man, she just does not look like your typical runner. She just does not look like your typical runner because she was strong. She's incredibly strong. She went on to be an Olympic athlete in the steeplechase. She was so strong, but she did not look like a waif. Like she didn't have that really, really skinny look that many runners typically had. And so I agree with you. I think that we're seeing more and more strong bodies. But even that can sometimes, I guess there's no one way that fast can look.
And that's the good thing right now. Like there is nothing wrong with being lean. There's nothing wrong with being naturally frail. There's not, I mean, frail isn't the wrong word, but there's nothing wrong with being muscular. There's nothing wrong with being athletic. But for my daughter to notice that the front pack just looked like her average soccer game where there's not a soccer prototype.
Right.
There's just a bunch of athletes on the field. We couldn't say that in a different generation.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to dive now Maura, into post-collegiate. Obviously, we're talking to you because of what you did here recently. And I imagine there's a lot we haven't even gotten to yet. Like, you found a boy, you kind of liked him, you got married, you made babies, you have a busy life, like you graduated and have a career and all those things. So walk us through what I really want to get to and spend the last part of this conversation talking about is, like, how do you do it? We have so many people that listen to this podcast, Maura, that are working full time, have the families, have the jobs, things we talk about they feel are unattainable or don't relate to them because of their schedule and their lives. And I totally get it, right? Well, we're talking to somebody who is doing it. And so I don't want to, like, forget about all that. That is what I want to focus on moving forward. But get us to, like, today really quick. Like, why don't we, like, fast forward Cliff Notes version, college until your adult-ish life.
Okay.
Give us a quick synopsis there.
Quick synopsis. I met my husband my freshman year at UD. He was also on the men's, cross country team. We were both rookie of the week. We were both rookie of the week the same week. That's how we got to talking. I definitely, I sought him out. I chased him. Still kind of feel like I lucked out on that one. So we dated all the way through, college. We got married the summer after we graduated. And we both got jobs in the Dayton area. I graduated, with my education degree. So I got a job teaching chemistry at a local Catholic school, and, he got a job as an engineer. And thank goodness, because all of the rumors about what teachers make are true. and we both kept running, mostly together. Our love of running, we kind of fed into each other's love of running. And so for a while before we had kids, it was something that we would go and do together. We both love to race. And I think that Dayton has a really, really strong running community that is constantly putting on races. So again, it just kind of comes back to, I would always seek community through running. So I would go to these races and I would meet new people. I would meet people that I wanted to spend more time with, people that I ended up running with, people that became some of my closest friends. Other girls that I ran with at UD ended up staying in the area and I would run with them. Once we started having kids, running just continued to be something that we prioritized. Like I remember when we got pregnant, with our first, with Maggie, so many people told me, like, you're not going to have time to run after you have kids. And I was like, we'll see. And you know, my house got dirtier and, I didn't stretch for as long as I probably should have, and laundry piled up, but, like, you kind of make time for the things that are really important, and running continued to be a priority. And then as we had our second and our third child, you know, there were other places that we made sacrifices. You know, I don't have a very nice looking garden. The lawn typically grows pretty long before we cut it. But running was always a priority. And so, and I think having a partner who is also a runner, you know, we both kind of supported each other and made sure that we both had that time, to get running in. I will be incredibly candid and say that, for the last 3 years, having three kids and training at the level that I've been training, and teaching full time, it has gotten to be too much. And so I'm actually, trying to go part time next year, just because the number of people who have said, like, wow, in this day and age, you know, women, they can have it all. And I'm like, I don't want it all anymore. It's too much. I need a break. I guess in terms of how did we do it? Having a partner that helped me make it a priority, helped me keep it a priority was critical. And also just having a community around me, running wasn't just a form of exercise for me. It wasn't just training. Running was also my social circle. It was my community. So, I didn't ever feel like I was missing out on, like, the opportunity to be social because I'm rarely running by myself. I have core group of people that I train with, and that is also my social time. So it kind of, because running is very community centered for me, it fills both of those needs.
Do you coach as well?
I did. I coached until I had my first child. So that was something that I had to leave behind, just because of the time commitment. I'd like to do it again at some point, but I think I need to be done with pursuing like my running goals first.
Yeah.
I think that then I'll be able to prioritize mm-hmm. other running goals better.
How do you know Kira? I should have asked right away, but I don't even know this answer. And now I'm curious hearing your story.
So Kira and her husband, Josiah, they moved to Dayton because she's in the Air Force. And so they were stationed mm-hmm. in Dayton for a couple of years, and they kind of immediately, like I would have done, sought out the running scene. And so I met her at a couple of group runs and then at a couple of races, and just, we immediately hit it off. She was immediately somebody that I was like, oh, I like you. I want to spend more time with you. So yeah, that's how we got to know each other. And we trained together, almost daily for about a year and a half.
Okay. That makes sense. I can wrap my head around that. She, when we started working together, Kira, she was, you know, am I a fool to be chasing OTQ, the Olympic Trials qualifying standard in the marathon? And then they lowered it, and she was, she's made a couple great attempts. Life has been nuts for her, right? I know she's still like, can I, what if, I maybe, I don't know. And she's still pushing pretty hard. And I know, I assume she wishes she could still train with you every day from what I'm gathering. She was very much looking forward to you being in town. It was Vegas, yeah. I believe you came to her.
Yes.
But speaking of Olympic trials qualifying standards, okay, again, this is for my stalking. My skills are average. Mm-hmm. Used to do it a lot more when I was younger. Now, not as much. 240 on the head, is that your personal best in the marathon? 240 and change?
Yeah, 240 and some change, yeah.
And so when you ran that, was that with the new standard below yes. that?
Yes. So that was...
okay.
Kind of my last big attempt to hit that new standard, that sub 237. And that was, I actually just, within the last couple of years, well, since June of 2021, I started training with James McCurdy. And that was kind of the goal that I laid out to him was, you know, they've lowered this standard. I'd like to go for it. So that was after they lowered the standard.
Okay. And for people, mathing is difficult, and I don't know the exact math on this, but people like numbers, runners like numbers. Olympic trials qualifying standard, roughly 6 flat per mile, let's call it, for women running 6 flat across the board. You ran 240. What does that put you at? 609 or something?
603.
Oh, 602.
Yeah. Okay. Because really, it's more like tight. 558, 557.
Okay, sure.
It was a really tight window. And honestly, at that race, I was on pace through like 30K, maybe even a little further than that. It just, when you are pushing your body to the absolute limit, there's a very small margin for error and everything has to go perfectly. And that day, it was my nutrition. My nutrition just wasn't on point during the race. I wasn't able to keep gel down. So I think that's probably what ended up doing it for me. But that's the beauty of the marathon. Like, you can be in the best shape of your life and it can absolutely humble you. Rarely does it work the other way. Rarely do you surprise yourself in a marathon. Rarely do you go into it undertrained and like pull out a spectacular performance. Sometimes you can do that in a 5K or 10K, but not the marathon.
Recently, we've been talking to a few athletes who have done big things in longer events. We had Charlie St. Lawrence on. St. Lawrence, is that correct? Charlie Lawrence. He set the world record in the 50 mile, you know, something stupid, 5:38 pace or something. Anyway, the conversation with all of them is that your college times didn't speak to this. Like, his 5K time was significantly inferior to his marathon time. And Kirk and I are the opposite. We were mid-distance runners, 815. our 800 meter time, our 1500 meter time says that we should be able to run a certain marathon time that we're not going to run. But right. you seem to be, just by the numbers you've said, like a flat line.
Mm.
Like your 3K kind of equates to your 5K, which kind of equates to your marathon. Is that just you have actualized yourself at every distance, or are you just that well-rounded as an athlete? What do you think that is?
I honestly don't know if I know how to answer that question. I didn't even, I guess I didn't even really put that together. Maybe I never had as much, maybe I still haven't met my full potential in some of those shorter distances. Maybe
I'm going to calculate this right now using Jack Daniel's VDOT here. 240 flat, let's say, for the marathon equates to a 1641 5K and a 937 3K.
So yeah, I mean, pretty close.
Wow. Did they use you as the centerpiece of this calculator? Or do you have some sort of side hustle partnership? You getting residuals from VDOT?
I'm just a utility runner, you know, throw me in anything from the 4x4 to the marathon and I'll do my best. But
so with that being said, have you decided what your best distance is, or do you just have a favorite?
I will be honest with you guys. I love racing. I haven't met a distance that I don't like. Actually, I think it was Ali Ostrander that just posted this recently on Instagram, and I loved it. And it was, any distance is the hardest distance if you're running it correctly. So like people will say like, oh, the 400 is the hardest, or, you know, because you hit that 200 meter mark and the monkey jumps on your back. Or the marathon is the hardest, or the half marathon is the hardest because it's just as taxing as the marathon, but you're running it way faster. Like, everybody thinks that certain races are more challenging than others. And I really think that every race has its merits, and it can be the hardest race if you're running it correctly.
I like that. I think on here one time, Kirk, I said the hardest race is one deviation from what you're training for. Because you're just fit enough to get to that spot, and you're not fit enough to like be totally comfortable at that spot. But either or, maybe I like hers more. I'm not sure.
I like hers more. Bragging. Okay, so let's open this book here. The Book of Motherhood.
Yeah.
All right, so you set your lifetime personal best within the last 6 months, was it? I don't know when you ran 240. When was that?
Yeah, it was in October.
Okay, great. October, so 6-7 months ago. In October, you've already had 3 children. You're 35, I think you said, and you've run a lifetime best in the marathon. Before we get to that, that sort of highlight point, let's talk about the baby fitness cycle. Let's talk about growing a baby, having a baby, getting back to fitness, or whatever term you want to use. Getting back to fitness might not be the right terminology. Let's talk about going through that cycle. Pregnancy. You find out you're pregnant. You train as you're growing and showing, and then baby comes, and then what happens? Like, can you actually walk us through that? We've done 3 times now. Tell us how your fitness has gone, how you've approached it, what your advice would be, all of that stuff.
So actually, with my first, I didn't run very much at all through that pregnancy because I was scared to. I wasn't sure what pregnancy would look like for me. I found out that I was pregnant coming off of a big marathon, and I was kind of dealing with some nagging injuries. And then by the time that those had resolved themselves, I had already gained a lot of weight. My center of gravity had shifted, and I was just like, well, I just won't run. And it was awful. That is probably the worst that I have felt. And it wasn't just because I was pregnant. I felt like very out of sync with my body. But through my second and third pregnancies, I decided to train, and I talked to my doctor about it, and she was like, whatever you do before you're pregnant, obviously with some pretty major exceptions, you can do while you're pregnant. And so through my second and third pregnancies, I trained, I ran pretty much the same mileage up until maybe like my 7th or 8th month. And then I really had to kind of back down the mileage, back down the intensity, just because I just had this big belly in the way. It is different with just about every single runner. Every single runner that goes through pregnancy is going to experience it in a slightly different way. I did not have a lot of morning sickness. So that didn't affect me very much in the first trimester. I know other runners who that was so detrimental. I didn't struggle with gestational diabetes. I did get a very big belly, and some runners don't. So it all kind of depends, but the process of running and training, for me, kind of hinged on just finding support for my big belly. So I had to get a belt that went underneath my belly and gave me support when I was running, especially like after the fifth or sixth month. That was something I had to wear every single time. And then just being aware of like not falling, because not only is your center of gravity shifted, your joints are also a lot looser. And so just making sure that I ran on solid surfaces that weren't particularly slick or full of cracks. Even with being careful, I did fall a couple of times. And that was always scary. But, you know, your body instinctively puts your hands out so that you're not falling directly on your belly. And then all three of my births were C-sections. So recovery looked a little different from somebody that would have a vaginal birth. So I had to wait 8 weeks before I was even allowed to do like intense walking. And so the progress back to running after having the baby, that 8 weeks of not running and just kind of slowly allowing my body to heal, was difficult, but it was also like planned downtime. I think that just about every PR that I currently have, with the exception of that 3K, is post babies. And most of them is actually post third baby. So I've continued to get faster after having babies. And I don't know if this is actually true, if it's just something I want to be true, but I think that having that kind of planned downtime where I'm not running and I'm not training has helped protect me from injury, from overuse, and has allowed me to kind of refocus each time with more intensity.
How do you feel? She won't mind if I talk about her, I don't think. Do you know who Ashlyn Talby is? She follows you on Instagram.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I do.
Okay. She's an athlete I coach as well, Ashlyn. And she's very pregnant right now. In fact, all the women in my life are pregnant right now, other than my wife, I believe. But I have like seven athletes who I'm currently coaching who are pregnant. My cohort, Steven, jokes that I get them all in such great shape and then their husbands can't keep their hands off of them. That's what he tells me, which I think is funny. But Ashlyn, met, you know, as you're pregnant. Now, I can't speak firsthand clearly because I'm a man, but... metrics eventually slow, right? As you're growing and developing baby eventually. And sometimes then there's rev limiter put on you. And I just told Ashlyn, cause she was like, the metrics are slower. She struggled with morning sickness very bad this first trimester, to the point where she couldn't run for a week or two. She's been in a tough place with it. Anyways, I want to know if I was right with this advice or not, but it's like, if we let go of the metrics and we let go of that and focus on simply like the joy of running right now, this is still an investment in your future running self post baby. Meaning like, instead of throwing your hands in the air and being like, what's the point? I don't care if you're running 2 minutes per mile slower. I don't care if we're running a third of the mileage. I don't care if you have to stop 3 miles in because you threw up and had to throw in the towel on the workout. Like, it's all still worth doing, because once you return to training post baby, that's money you've put in the bank that you can take out from later.
I 100% agree.
Do you agree with that?
I 100% agree. And I honestly would go so far as to say, like, any training that you're able to do while pregnant is a win. It doesn't matter what it looks like. It doesn't matter if it's Galloway running where you're just doing some running and some walking. It does not matter. It's all a win, because it looks different for everybody. There's no way that you can write like a great training plan for a pregnant person especially if they are, if this is their first pregnancy. But even if it isn't their first, all three of mine were slightly different. You know, all three of mine felt different. So yeah, I would say focusing entirely on feel rather than on the metrics is the way to go.
What was your return? What you had 8 weeks because of your C-section, and then you had obviously different internal trauma with that via vaginal birth. But when you began to start having impact again and then running, and my wife found with her three that it was not at all and then all at once. Like, I'll never feel good again. I'll never feel good again. I'm starting to just run well. You know, you have that heightened density of red blood cell and that is waiting for you. And there are other little things that nature does for you to help you get back to good. But like, did you find that to be your route back, or was it different for you?
Yes, very much so. I will say that with each birth, it took longer. So after my first birth, I was back to high intensity running after about 4 or 5 months. After my second, it was more like 6 to 8 months. And then after my third, it took almost a full year, maybe even a little longer with more bumps in the road. So, so it took longer. That might also have just been because I was getting older too. Who knows exactly what happened, but I definitely agree that like you start out those first, like, 3 or 4 weeks of running back, you're struggling to do like 9:30 pace or 10 minute pace when normally, you know, I would have been doing 7:40 to 8 minute pace for an easy run. And I'm struggling to even keep it under 10. And then all of a sudden, like it just, you know, after maybe a week of it starts to feel a little bit better. And then it's like, oh, when I'm back to where I was, back to where I feel like I could maybe throw in some speed. So,
I was giving you a chance there, Bracken, to jump in. I'm
just riding out the delay in case it's there.
There is a delay. Okay, so I know you're probably going to get flooded with kids in like 20 minutes, I'm assuming, outside the school. So I want to get to everything we need to get to before you. Is that when school gets out in 20 minutes from now?
Yes. Yep. You're right
on. Good. So we're going to aim for that. So we have a few things to get to on its way to that. One of the major things I want to know, right? We talked about you got how many irons in the fire, or you're juggling a lot of balls, or whatever you want to call it with life and training. I think the listeners would, and me too. What are the sacrifices made? You said your lawn looks shitty and the laundry sits out sometimes, but like, that's so relatable for people. Like, you have to pick and choose where you put your time and priority. But I think I want to know, like, what does the day-to-day, week-to-week look like more on a micro level? Like, what time does Maura have to get up? And what does the schedule look like? What is husband doing while you're doing what you're doing, and vice versa? I think I want to understand, like, the mileage run, everything. Like, walk us through what it takes to be a near Olympic trials qualifying standard marathoner.
So most of my days start somewhere between 4:15 and 4:45 a.m. A lot of my running happens either early in the morning or after school. And really there's two time windows for training for when running can happen. And that's either at 5 or 5:15 a.m. or at like 3:45, 4 p.m. And because my husband and I both run, we have to very highly coordinate who gets which running window each day. And neither of us want all mornings or all afternoons. We have to switch back and forth because neither of us want to get up at 4:15 every morning. So every Sunday we sit down and we make a calendar, and we decide first, we put all of the different appointments on the calendar. So who's got a doctor's appointment, who's taking my daughter to therapy, who's, you know, when do I have office hours? When am I going to physical therapy? All this stuff.
This sounds like what would happen if a teacher and an engineer got together.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yes. Two type A personalities. And then we factor in running. And it's not just our running. We both like to meet other people to run. So occasionally I'll be like, well, you know, my people want to meet on Wednesday morning for a workout. So I definitely want the morning on Wednesday. And we figure out when each of us is going to run each day. And then we figure out who's going to do pickup and who's going to do drop off, because that is critical. We have three kids in two different locations right now. One of them goes to daycare and the other two go to grade school. And so typically whoever's running in the morning is going to be doing pickup in the afternoon. And whoever's running in the afternoon is going to be doing drop off in the morning. And that's how we do it. It's highly scheduled. And what typically doesn't happen in a day are things like watching TV or cleaning the house, getting groceries. All of those things have to happen on the weekends. And honestly, that kind of the nuts and bolts of like keeping a household running is where I feel the most pressure on a weekly basis, is just keeping up with like all the papers that need to be signed and who needs field trip money and what are we going to eat for the next week? And when's the last time somebody has scrubbed the toilets? When's the last time somebody's cleaned the cat litter? Those kinds of things I feel like weigh the most heavily, which is silly because they're like the small things, right? But because we prioritize all the big stuff, the small stuff really can pile up. So after teaching for...
If somebody walked into your house today, what would you be the most embarrassed of? You'd be like, oh God, I hope they don't see that. Let's talk through the embarrassment list.
I have not unpacked my suitcase from Boston.
That is my MO. And yes, it drives my wife nuts.
It's still sitting fully packed. Like I've unzipped the little packing
cage. Dirty running clothes in there.
Oh, 100%.
All of it?
Yep.
Mm-hmm, nice.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that would probably be it. Also, I wouldn't advise anyone to walk barefoot across any of my floors because you're going to pick up a metric ton of crumbs and cat hair. But yeah, that after one of us runs in the morning, the other one does drop off, and then we both work. Both of us have the luxury of working pretty stable, like your typical like 9 to 5. It's really more like 8 to 4 jobs. But then when all of us are home, we do try to eat dinner together at least 3 or 4 nights a week. And then sometimes after dinner, I'm going right back out the door to go lift. Or sometimes I wait until after bedtime and then I'll go out and lift. So I'll sometimes be logging like time in the weight room at 9:30 at night. I guess another thing that really suffers, and I don't recommend this, is sleep. That's another place where I feel like I've cut a lot of corners. And I think some people do okay with less sleep. And I think I happen to be one of them. I typically get like more like 5.5 to 7 hours. Whereas I know other athletes who like they need 8 hours or more, or they're not able to perform at their best. But, yeah, that's definitely an area of my life that gets optimized.
Bracken often says something and it sticks with me, and I want to know what you think of this. I'm just going to steal your... I think of you a lot with this saying, Bracken. You don't know this.
Ooh.
But there's people out there that aren't as busy as you. Not even close, right? And I'm just like, you're a well-oiled machine because you have no other choice if you want to get this done and live the way you live. And he often says, if you can't do it without all of these things in your life, or if you can't do it with all of these things in your life, you're not going to be able to do it without these things in your life either. Meaning like, well, Bracken, what do you mean by that? Why don't you take the floor? But do you agree with that sentiment being like, I think people claim they're too busy. They don't get enough sleep. They got too much emotional and physical baggage. Their day is too hectic. And they claim that if they had more time or freedom, that they would nail it. And know what? I think they're all full of shit. I think none of them would nail it. I think they're making excuses and finding a way so that they justify their inability to get it done. That's what I think. And so if you can't do it with all that going on, you're not going to be able to do it without. I guess I just explained it for you, Bracken. Sorry. I believe that wholeheartedly, and Bracken cemented that in me. Do you think that's true or not?
I mean, definitely to an extent. I think I would phrase it more as you make time for the things that are most important to you.
Mm-hmm.
And
quit making me sound bad there with your better answer.
I want to be clear.
No, I'm kidding.
This was initially said in response to when someone posts a positive result online and the trolls go, yeah, if I had 20 hours and people paying me to train, I could do that too. And it's like, no, if you can't do it without Correct. That, you won't do it for it. Like you, for example, have gotten to the point where you're ready to back off work because you've done everything you can do. You've proved that you are willing to do it. And now it's just not beneficial to your life to keep beating your head against the wall. But you've proved you're willing to beat your head against the wall. You know, so yeah. your response is correct that you make time for the things that are important. And my response to them would be like, you know what? You know when you don't want it bad enough is when your alarm goes off and you go back to sleep. That's when you know how bad you want something. And so if you can't do it then, if someone was paying you $80,000 with a shoe contract without being there to wake you up, you're still not going to get up and get it done.
Right. Yeah. And honestly, I do kind of have this fear that even if I do go part-time next year, that I'll have this extra time and that it'll be wasted because I've been doing it without this extra time for so long, like that maybe I won't be able to fully optimize that extra time, but we'll see. That remains to be seen.
Yeah. My comment's
I think
not
2 hours of sleep would go a long ways. 2 hours sleep would go a long ways.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what you find out.
You
right?
guys buttoned up what I said.
You find out that the pro life is not let's sleep in as late as we can and lounge around. It's set your alarm clock, get the work done, and then you can always nap if you want. Or then you can go to the grocery store if you want. Or then you can double if you want. But it's not I'm going to push my start day back. No, it's I start when I start, but I get to finish and have time. That's what, you know, the button down pros do. And that's what you're going to end up doing.
Yeah. And I would also say that, especially for any other moms or dads that are listening to this, one other place that I feel like really gets, I guess, the short end of the stick with all of this that we are doing is our kids are not very involved. Our kids, you know, we have them in a couple of very low commitment sports and activities, but none of our kids are on a travel soccer team. None of our kids are involved in competitive dance or anything like that. Because we just don't have the time. We don't have the time commitment to devote to their stuff as well as ours. And whether or not, you know, I'm sure that there are people that will listen to that and think, well, that's just selfish. Maybe it is, but that is one place that probably eventually we will see a shift where we're focusing more on their activities and less on our own. I personally have the opinion that, my oldest daughter's 8. Many of her peers are overcommitted at this point as 8-year-olds are doing a lot. And our kids are just, they're very minimally involved. And I would love to say that that's just my parenting philosophy, but really it's just it's a necessity because of our lifestyle.
Well, that would be an example of, no, go ahead, Bracken.
No, finish that up. I was going a different direction.
We can move it. We got to move this thing along. We got like 9 minutes, so go a different direction.
Well, what I'm curious with is that with your husband training and you training and 2 slots of the day, plus sometimes a PM lift, is what kind of training theory and system you incorporate? What are you a double person? Are you a lot more of long singles? Do you double certain days? Like what, how do you go about skinning the marathon cat?
I am definitely more of a long singles, but it is purely out of necessity. I would double if I had the option. I think the doubles are a great way to get in that extra mileage without putting as much time on feet in one go. But for this training cycle, I was definitely more of long singles. And I'm also not super high mileage for a marathoner. I usually tap out sometimes maybe 75 to 85 miles a week, which is pretty low for most like runners who are training to hit the times that I'm training to hit. I just don't have time to do 100 mile weeks.
I still think 80 on singles is worth darn near 100 in doubles. I get what you're saying and you're right. But long singles, if you can survive it, that has some staying power to it.
Yes. Probably less. I will, this
maybe
this is,
90.
Yeah, this is maybe not a huge factor that a lot of people think about, but having to shower twice a day is kind of a lot. And that's a big time commitment as well. So just having to shower once, that saves, it's not just the running, it's the prep time.
I don't find it to be that big of an issue.
Oh, well, I've got I'm just pretty kidding. Long hair.
Yeah. I am dry the moment I step out of the shower. And that is one of the only benefits of male pattern baldness. So then next year, is that something you're looking to incorporate? And are you nervous about switching up training style? Or are you just all in on, hey, I get to double now, I get to not have to go so long on certain singles? Or are you not even to that point yet?
I'm honestly, I can't even begin to think what my life is going to look like with that extra time. I don't even have like my schedule yet. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but I would like to, what I would like to do is make weekends more family time, because I'm able to, in the middle of the week, do things like get the house cleaned up, do laundry, get the groceries. Because right now all that happens on the weekends, and we do a pretty good job of just including our girls in all of those things, but those aren't really fun activities. So if weekends could be a little less trying to get all of the housework done and also trying to get in the bulk of our weekly mileage, because you know the weekend is when the long run or the big weekend workout happens, just taking pressure off the weekends is what I'm most looking forward to.
That makes sense.
So what are your hot tips for busy parents and training? Any bullet point advice that we didn't talk about? Any like, aha, this helped or that helped, or any philosophy there, anything that people need to hear in that regard that we haven't covered?
I honestly would say the thing that has helped me the most is just to not should on yourself, to not focus on what other parents are doing, because very, very few parents are trying to train to run fast times in a marathon or to run fast times in a half marathon. Most likely, the majority of people around you are not going to be doing what you're doing. And you will look at them and think, I should be involving my kids in more activities. I should be making breakfast for my kids in the mornings instead of just pouring bowls of cereal. There's a whole litany of things that we feel like we should be doing and we're not doing them well enough. And to just embrace the fact that what you're doing is atypical. And so it's not going to look like what the internet says parenting should look like, or what your neighbor says parenting should look like, or what your mother-in-law says parenting should look like. It's going to look different. And it's not even going to look like what mine looks like. It's going to look, you know, your family best, you know, your kids best, you know, what works best for your family, and just lean into it, because you know what is best, to trust yourself.
It's really good.
It's the same advice I got before my wedding. They said, if the thing is, oh, well, we should do this or we should have that, if you have to say the word should, it's out.
Yep.
You shouldn't do anything if it doesn't feel right. And then, Bracken, if you want to wedge something else in here, of course, we're into the wire, but I just want to know what the heck you're trying to do here. In you have an Olympic cycle in 4 years, so it seems like forever away. I assume you're pushing hard for goals. What are you hoping to accomplish here coming up?
Definitely pursuing the sub-237. It's not something I'm ready to quit on just yet. Provided they don't lower the time standard again, definitely chasing that time goal. But also just continuing to compete. Racing is one of my favorite parts of running. And I love amazing athletes. And one of my favorite parts about Boston was just that it wasn't a race where anyone was really worried about the time. It was more about just being gritty and competing and who could outlast and, you know, who could execute the best race plan for the heat of the day and the hills. And that's really what I love. So just being able to continue to compete and, you know, that sub-237 goal, if I don't get it, I don't think that I'll look back on this next training cycle as a failure. But I'm not quite ready to set it aside.
Yeah, I think we both identify with that.
It's funny, a lot of people listening will be like, it's only 3 minutes, Maura. It's 3 minutes. Like, that's not that much. Of course you're going to do that. Like, it's easy to take 3 minutes off your marathon. You have 26 miles to do it. It's not the case, is it?
No. And really, it's that last 10K. That's what I got to figure out. That last 10K when you've already been pushing at your absolute max for 30K. Just being able to have everything go right for the first 30K, to have all the nutrition be where it needs to be, to not get a blister, to not get cramps, and just be able to execute that last 10K. Honestly, I think that most people that have done enough marathons know that, that last 10K is where people make or break their races.
Yeah. So as we wrap this up, we're going to wrap it up actually right now. Can people follow along with what you're doing? Like, are you much of a poster, keep people in the loop, or if people want to, you know, see what you're doing, can they, should they?
Yeah, absolutely. So my Instagram is not private. Even though I am a teacher, I don't think a lot of my students find me particularly interesting, so I don't think a lot of them follow me. but I do post a lot about my running, and about just things around being a female athlete on my Instagram. It's just @Maura_Lemon.
Thank you so much, Maura. I appreciate the conversation today. It was a good one. This is one that's going to get a lot of traction, a lot of responses from this, because it was just so applicable to most people who are out there trying to run and live life.
Thank you so much for having me, for being patient through all the technological issues. I really appreciate this. And yeah, this was really cool. I've never really done anything like this before.
You seem like a pro.
I'm glad I come off that way.
Maura, you have yourself a good day. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
If anything resonated with you on today's episode and you're curious about taking your training to the next level, check out therunningpublic.com, where we have a training plan to fit your needs.